the local regulators tried to ban Uber because they thought that it was providing like taxi services, and taxis are regulated and Uber were not. But then Uber gave free rides to drivers. They mobilized the driver and the user base. And then in the words of the legislators, Uber became too big to ban. It's a very common strategy. Use a loophole to get started and then you grow very, very fast and then it becomes too big to ban.
Hello, today I have on the show Paolo Savage. He's written a fantastic book called The Four Workarounds, and he captures the essence of, I think, what it means to be an entrepreneur. His examples, or because he's a business school professor, his case studies, his cases are all scrappy businesses. He's got some big businesses, but they're all. He's also got some great scrappy ones. And so it is how to solve a problem, life-changing problem in the jungle in South America around diarrhea. But it's the how do we get distribution solved? And his whole book was, I wonder if I can look at computer hackers. And is there a thing that computer hackers do, which is to use a bit of brain power and minimal resources to overturn a big system? Can I take some things from that, which are then applicable more broadly? And he realized that was nonsense. But when he looked at success of scrappy firms, he found four things that they always did that drove their success. Only four. And so we're going to talk through those. But I think it means if you've got a team and a business and a problem, this book should give people the tools to say, how could we look at this differently? Is there a thing we could piggyback on? Is there a loophole we could apply? And we talk about Uber as an example of loopholing. And so it gives you a language to talk about strategic options to get a team to innovate and be scrappy and win and have fun, because it's so much more fun to win and be scrappy than it is to spend a load of money. Excellent conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paolo Savage. I'm an associate professor at the University of Oxford. I have a joint appointment between engineering and the business school, which makes me a bit of an oddball at the university. And I'm the author of a book called The Four Workarounds, Strategies from the World's Scrappiest Organizations for Tackling Complex Problems.
Thank you for coming on. Look, I read your book and I thought I've got to get you onto the show because that's my life, right? Having been in sort of startup scrappy businesses, all of these are, you know, like these are things. And I thought, oh, this is just fascinating that somebody has codified or, you know, and the case studies are fantastic. But what made you, like, what's the backstory? How do you end up with a book? Well, no, maybe I've got another question before that. How come you're doing engineering and business school? And then we'll do the, like, why the book? Or maybe they're connected.
They are connected. I'm in engineering and business because I'm interested in technologies and systems, but also in how we can organize to amplify the impact of technologies and changes in systems. So I bridge them both, and I'm usually interested in sustainability. So I usually approach problems, complex problems like poverty, inequality, climate change, by bridging these different disciplines. And I got to this research in a very unexpected way. Right. I was working as a consultant back then. I was not in academia. And I came across many cases that I was consulting for where I was working with this systems thinking approach. But these cases were very different. They were, for example, in the Amazon with traditional populations. So with a very large company in a high-end office in São Paulo or international development organizations. And I realized that with my systems thinking approaches, I was recommending things that were relatively similar and they were very generic. I recommended more coordination, more cooperation, more alignment, things that were not necessarily wrong. But I realized that I was missing out on different ways of approaching systems change. And that led me to start this research on how computer hackers hack complex computational systems. Because my idea was, can we approach systems change like hackers do? Hackers enter these very complex computer systems, just having a laptop and not having much knowledge about the cybersecurity systems. And they still find ways of making change very resourcefully and very immediately. So could we learn from computer hackers to use their approaches in other systems that are not computational, whether it's in an energy system or in a healthcare system? That's how I started this research.
And just for those people who don't know, what's a quick definition of systems thinking?
Systems thinking is thinking beyond the boundaries of a single organization and what a single organization can do. It's usually thinking across different boundaries, crossing silos. It's thinking about how the sum of the parts are not necessarily the whole. The whole is much more than the sum of the parts. Because there are many complexities that arise throughout these processes. It's a series of concepts and toolkits that allow us to understand complex situations and approach problem solving in different ways.
Are these the only four? I mean, when you did your research, did you start with a long list and go, no, that's still piggybacking, no, that's still loopholing, like, you know, and did you end up with a longer list and like, oh my God, there's just four?
The long story is that I started with computer hackers.
Yeah.
And I realized that my assumption was wrong when collecting data from hackers. They told me there are already many hackers out there, right? My idea was I will learn from computer hackers and transpose their approach to other systems. And they said, hacking is not exclusive to computer systems. There are people hacking all kinds of systems out there. And these are usually scrappy organizations, like the ones that you described and that you have been doing your entire life. You were hacking systems, yeah. Right? And I pivoted my research and I started studying scrappy organizations doing precisely that and in very resourceful and immediate ways, but with outsized impacts. Once I pivoted, I collected data from 9 countries and then kept collecting data. And I did what researchers like me do. Like, you get a lot of data, you get a big cup of coffee, some pubs to get you going, and then you crunch that data and you find patterns across all your data entries. And that's when I identified these four approaches, this what I call the four workarounds.
And it's funny because I've got one of my favorite stories is, you know, you've got British Airways, you know, they go out to market. It feels like ancient history now, and they're in version 2 of this. But they were the first airline to put flatbeds in business class, and so, you know, they made a big splash about flatbeds in business class. And then Virgin Atlantic obviously didn't have beds in, but because they're the challenger, they did a press release that said, you know, there's British Airways with their beds in, but we've got double beds with curtains around them and a no questions asked policy in our business class, which was a complete lie, right? Because they didn't have it at all. But because they're the challenger brand and they have a brand, their brand allows them to be cheeky and make things up. You know, they were able to like do that piggybacking on the back of that sort of PR newsjacking. And as a, you know, having, as I say, spending all my time in scrappy businesses, is that to me is like it's worth so much more if you're in Virgin, because not only did you score some points, but BA hate you, right? And so, you know, it's poking them in the eye, and in some ways it almost doesn't matter if the thing doesn't work with BA, because the joy you get out of poking them in the eye is worth the effort, right? Or I remember being in the US and CNN carried a thing on Ryanair, saying that Ryanair were going to start charging people to use €1 to use the toilet. And like, here's an airline that doesn't even fly in the US getting global news coverage for another spoof PR release or, you know, some other malicious leak from some, you know, internal document, which of course, you know, their PR stance is, you know, the airline that everybody hates to fly with. And so, I've always had that, I don't know, it just, there's a joy in being scrappy, right? Like there's a sense of satisfaction that you get to win when, like, if you're a big company and you've got all the resources in the world, well, you should never fail, right? And so I've always been drawn to scrappy businesses and trying to make things up and, you know, no, change the rules. So I thought the case studies were brilliant. Look, but I still, are you sure there's only four? It feels like four doesn't feel like it's enough. It feels like there should be three or six. It's like, I don't know, just like four doesn't seem the right number.
Well, perhaps I can convince you four and how they are different from each other.
Right, go on then.
And how you can combine these workarounds as well, right? Because sometimes you see the end result and you ignore that there were many workarounds that were sequenced or stacked to create that outcome.
There's another thing I'd like you to try and persuade me of, right, as we go through. Can we teach this to people? Or are you sort of born scrappy?
You can definitely teach people, and
that's brilliant. In which case, people should like get a cup of coffee and pay attention.
I hope so. Yeah, get two espressos instead of one.
Excellent. Let's go. Should we dive into the first one then? And because we've got four, so the way you do it in the book, you've got the workaround, and then you've got a case study sort of as a way of, I guess, business school way of teaching it to us. So maybe we go and dive into these.
And I have multiple cases, right, of each, but I think they bring different elements that can be highlighted for each of these workarounds. But let me exemplify the first one, the piggyback. I worked with this organization in Zambia called Kola Life, and they realized that you don't find life-saving medicines in remote regions, including medicine that are extremely cheap. People living in extreme poverty could afford, like diarrhea treatment. Diarrhea is the second biggest killer of children under the age of 5 in many low-income countries. And the medicine could be afforded by people living in extreme poverty. Yet, they cannot find these medicines. They're not available where these people reside. So why, right? And then you stop, again, systems thinking that we were discussing before. You try to identify the obstacles preventing the medicine from being found. Obstacles include, for example, big pharma companies not interested in selling cheap products to people that live in scattered regions, right? And creating many logistical challenges for them as well. The infrastructure being very poor, like roads and other infrastructure related to digital and communications as well. So then you're going to map out all these different obstacles that are so challenging to tackle. And if you are a scrappy organization, you don't have the resources or the time necessarily to tackle these obstacles, because it might take many years, decades to tackle them, you may try to find a workaround. So what did this organization do? They realized that you don't find these medicines, but you find Coca-Cola everywhere. Uh-huh. Coca-Cola it's really incredible. You go to the remotest places on Earth, you're going to find only a few products, and one of them will likely be Coca-Cola or any other soft drink. And Coca-Cola has a very decentralized system. Coca-Cola doesn't necessarily take the bottles to remote regions. Coca-Cola has a local bottler. The local bottler sells to a wholesaler, to a retailer, to supermarkets, and then people will carry the Coca-Cola bottles from one place to the other, and then from that place to another place. So it's a very decentralized system. And they realized if there's an entire system in place that takes Coca-Cola bottles from urban regions to the remotest places on Earth where people need the medicine, why can't we literally fit medicines, the diarrhea medicines, between bottles in a Coca-Cola crate to take a free ride with these bottles and reach these regions? And that was the beginning of an intervention that increased the uptake from less than 1% to about 50% in many regions of Zambia, and it's now scaling to other countries as well. So that shows us, and this is a very powerful example, but there are many other piggybacks for different reasons, right? But the reason why I like this so much is that it reminds us that we usually think that we have to address a problem in healthcare by building on the healthcare system.
Uh-huh.
We don't think that we can crisscross systems, right? We can piggyback on the fast-moving consumer goods system that is already so effective in reaching remote regions to address a problem in healthcare.
Yeah.
It's changing that lens from scarcity in healthcare to abundance in another system, and the ability of finding these unconventional pairings that can help you work around very tough obstacles and reach incredible results.
Yes, which is solving the distribution problem. And so is the diarrhea medicine sold or provided free?
Both. They started the intervention selling through the private sector. So the just to explain what the medicine is about, it's a combination of oral rehydration salts that come in a sachet and you dilute in a specific amount of water and dispense to a child, and zinc, a tablet. And it's important to have both. The medicine has been recommended by the World Health Organization for decades and is extremely cheap. There's no overdosage. It's over the counter, so anyone can sell that medicine. It doesn't need a prescription from any healthcare facility. So in remote regions, they are very far from health clinics. So imagine if you are in rural Zambia and you have a child with diarrhea, and the nearest clinic is about 15 to 20 kilometers from your house. Sorry, I don't do miles. I'm sure
you're... Yeah, no, that's fine. It's fine.
Your listeners would rather have me talk about miles, but let's say 10 to 12 miles from your house.
Yeah.
And then you have to walk with a child with diarrhea because there's no infrastructure. Like, there's no roads. You don't have a car. It's really challenging, right? So even if you think that these healthcare facilities in rural Zambia will have the medicine, because they often don't, they stock out or they don't know what to prescribe to a child with diarrhea. But even if you think that they do, imagine the challenge of reaching these places. And that's why it's so important to have the medicine sold in private shops as well. And every remote region you go to, there will be a local shop selling soap, selling a few industrialized products, right?
And Coca-Cola.
And Coca-Cola. And now diarrhea medicine.
Okay. Fab. And did the shop not think to stock it before, right? Because it sounds as though that would be, you know, it's like as useful as Coca-Cola or more useful as Coca-Cola and soap if you're the shopkeeper. It just hasn't occurred to the shopkeepers, or even if they did, they had nowhere. There was just no distribution mechanism. So you make the distribution mechanism and then the whole thing becomes self-perpetuating.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the latter. So if you are a shopkeeper in a very remote region, you don't even know about a product sold in an urban region because you don't buy from an urban region. You buy from someone who's sometimes cycling or with a motorbike, driving around. Like in Zambia, when I did field work in Zambia, I would very often see someone riding a bike with a crate of Coca-Cola, a gold, and a few industrialized products kind of like strapped around the bike, right? And that's what reaches these regions, and that's what they can purchase.
Yeah, so it's not as if there's a catalog. They're buying from the guy on the bike, and it's whatever he's got on his bike. So if you put the medicine on the bike, they buy the medicine.
Exactly. And in the beginning, they literally fit the medicine between bottles in a Coca-Cola crate, right? So even using that space. And then they realized that the space wasn't the most important thing. The important thing was to make sure that everyone within that system that moves Coca-Cola, that profits from selling Coca-Cola, would also be interested in moving, selling, and profiting from the diarrhea medicine as well.
Okay. Fab. So creating an entire supply chain.
Not creating, it's repurposing, right?
But were they able to tap into Coca-Cola at all for funding? Like once they had something going, does it become a thing you can ask Coca-Cola for some funding for this type of initiative?
Coca-Cola has no idea where the bottles go. It's really fascinating. It's a very decentralized system that they have. Sometimes they don't even, and very often actually, they don't even bottle the bottles. In Zambia, the bottler was SAB Miller.
That is
sometimes a competitor of Coca-Cola because they also sell other beverages that they produce. And I think that actually makes this intervention even more powerful because it doesn't need to be authorized by anyone. You can simply start the intervention. You can just do it, right?
Fab. So that's piggybacking, which I can get, because quite often one of the things that we do is when we're doing strategy work with clients, we say, you know, they're trying to solve the problem from their own perspective. And so here you're saying, if I think about it in strategy perspective with our clients, it'd be who's the end user? Who's our ideal? You know, what problem do they have? And who else reaches them?
Exactly.
You know, and how do we hijack, use, make use of their distribution? Who else is selling to our existing customers? Who can we partner with? What other avenues exist? That's fab.
It's exactly about that. It's finding unconventional pairings. And as you said earlier, there's so many piggybacks in marketing. You mentioned the Virgin, British Airways, right? And many others like that, because it's so much about leveraging the topic that people are talking about now, or any successful marketing campaign, you can piggyback on that, right? And the, I have some cases in the book, like how the producers of SpongeBob, the movie, piggybacked on 50 Shades of Grey, right?
That seems highly unlikely, but I'd like, oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah, it was reminding parents to take their children to the movie theater as well, right?
And
it was such a clever marketing strategy. Or like how Oreo piggybacked on the Super Bowl when there was an energy outage in one of the Super Bowls.
Yeah.
They very quickly leveraged that momentum, right? They piggybacked on that to promote their brand for free without dropping a dime.
Yes, because it was the Super Bowl, the coverage of the Super Bowl went down, and they jumped on social media, didn't they? And they said, okay, now's the time to go make a cup of tea and get some, like, sit down and have a tea and biscuits.
They made a pun about, like, energy outage. I don't remember exactly the pun.
Yeah.
But that went viral, right? And they very quickly leveraged that. Like, people went, if there's an energy outage and you're no longer watching Super Bowl, you're going to take your phone, right? You're going to see things on social networks. So they got a lot of views for that, because of course they were also searching for things that were Super Bowl related, the outage.
Yes, very good. So what's the next one then?
The next one I call the loophole.
Yeah.
So if roughly speaking, the piggyback is about finding unconventional pairings, crisscrossing systems. The loophole is about rules. And because you're working around rules, it can be a bit controversial. So just a trigger warning that, like, sometimes people may agree or not with the loopholes that are being used. It depends on your values, right? Let me share an example of a controversial one so that you can understand the logic. This organization from the Netherlands was formed by feminist women who think that anyone who wants an abortion service should be granted one. So that's the premise that they started, and they realized that the obstacle preventing them from getting an abortion service is primarily the legislation of the country where people reside. So if, for example, they are in the Netherlands, they can get a safe and legal abortion service. In Poland, it's illegal. In Brazil, where I grew up, it's illegal. In the US, it depends on the states now, right? So they realize that it's pretty much the legislation that constrains legal and safe abortions. And then the loophole that they use to work around these legislational constraints, the first one, because they use so many, they rented a ship from the Netherlands, not a ship, a boat, boat.
Yes.
And they sail to places where abortion is illegal. So let's say they go to Poland or Brazil. And then people who want to get an abortion service go on board, and they sail to international waters, which is about 12 miles from the coast.
Yeah.
It's really close by, doable from an operational perspective. And in international waters, the legislation that applies is the one of the flag of the boat. It's not about where people usually reside. It's where people are, right? And the legislation in international waters is the one of the flag of the boat. So in other words, they are in Dutch soil. And the Netherlands has a pro-choice legislation. So they can provide on that boat, a safe and legal abortion service to them, and then take them back to where they reside without transgressing any law. And they do that systematically. They found many other loopholes, but that's the essence, right? We usually think that we have to comply to the rules of where we are, but sometimes you can reinterpret the rules and leverage the ambiguity of the rules. Or you can find entirely different rule systems, like use the rules from the Netherlands for the benefit of people who do not reside in the Netherlands.
Yeah. Well, and you've seen that with Uber, where they rolled out their app. And in many places they rolled it out, it's like, it's not legal. Or, you know, there was protests, or people took them to court. And it's like, well, okay. But, you know, it is likely if 2 million or 4 million people or whatever are using our app and the government says we're going to shut you down, there might be then some outcry. And I don't know if you've read the Elon Musk biography by William Isaacson, right? Lots of the things that NASA say have to be true for building rockets, you know, turn out not to be really rules. They're just common practice that, you know, and so once you have that mindset of all rules are made up, then how do we challenge this? Like what, and it wasn't there one, isn't there one where one of the countries, they also then had to have doctors on board, or like, you know, there ended up being some extra logistical hoops they had to go through, but it didn't stop them. It was okay. They managed to keep going. It's just,
the case of Uber is really interesting for that, right? Because it's a bit different from the case I just described, but still a loophole. What happened with Uber was they never, in the beginning of the company, associated Uber with taxis, even though we all know that it's an alternative to taxis, right? Like, you don't want to take a taxi, you take an Uber, because yes, it might be more convenient, cheaper, and so on and so forth. They framed the whole business as sharing economy, or they framed us, oh, this is a new technology, digital technologies that have not yet been regulated by the state. And the reason for that was because they didn't want to be outregulated very quickly, because they knew that they were actually providing a service that was very similar to taxis. So what Uber did was they leveraged this ambiguity in the regulations by saying that it's new, it's not regulated yet, these new technologies.
It's a ride-sharing app. It's a ride-sharing app. We're not a taxi company. We don't employ any taxi drivers and we don't own any taxis.
Exactly. It's a platform business, right? It's not a taxi. So they use that a lot to grow. Yes. And if you look at Uber in the beginning, they were not really profiting, right? They were investing massively in growing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And one of the reasons for that was because of what you said, it's a strategy that we call too big to ban.
Yeah.
Once you are too big, right? Like, and let's say in New York, for example, the local regulators tried to ban Uber because they thought that it was providing like taxi services, and taxis are regulated and Uber were not. But then Uber gave free rides to drivers. They mobilized the driver and the user base. And then in the words of the legislators, Uber became too big to ban. It's a very common strategy. Use a loophole to get started and then you grow very, very fast and then it becomes too big to ban.
And I think Airbnb the same. And so the regulation is now catching up with Airbnb and licensing and banning and, you know, taxing. But at the beginning, there's no legislation in place. And so, you know, capture the market.
Exactly. It's reinterpreting the rules, right? Like it's finding ambiguities or claiming that it's a void. It's something that has no regulation. Yes. This is a strategy that is used very often for businesses like platform businesses.
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation. Oh, and I suppose there are always businesses who come along and try to persuade everyone that it's a loophole, and actually it's just, they are downright fibbing about it. I was just thinking, you know, there's this sort of fake it till you make it thing, which isn't a loophole, but you know, somebody else got caught doing that the other day, where I think they said it was some sort of artificial intelligence and it was people in the Philippines. There was no, you know, trying to say he had software when he didn't. Anyway, what's the next one?
The next one I call the next best, and it's about resources. So if the first one, roughly speaking, piggyback, is about different relationships, crisscrossing systems, the second one about rules, whether you are reinterpreting them or you are leveraging different rule systems, the third one is about recombining or repurposing resources. So let me give you an example from a social entrepreneur. And you probably realize that I have cases of companies that were startups and now are multi-billion dollar cases. But I also really enjoy cases of these very scrappy social entrepreneurs and nonprofits, because I think we have so much to learn from them.
Yes.
And they have been overlooked.
Well, it's true that sort of lack of resources drives innovation. And so often that's what, you know, a company gets to a particular size. And actually one of the things is they lose their scrappiness. And, you know, they lose their soul and often their profitability. That mindset just disappears.
Exactly, yeah. And I think we have so much. We usually, the business world has told many scrappy organizations that they have to behave like these flagship companies around the world.
You've got to grow up. You've got to professionalize.
Yeah, and I think it's like there's the opposite as well, right? Like these large companies have so much to learn from the scrappy ones. And that's why I try to like raise the profile and also like build on the knowledge of these scrappy organizations. But the next best, the social entrepreneur who wasn't a social entrepreneur back then, he was traveling in Bornell and he realized that mobile phones were constantly discarded, right? That it's one of the fastest growing categories of electronic waste. You probably, Dominic, had more than, 8, 10 phones in your lifetime?
Very probably.
Yeah, I certainly did, yeah. But these phones can still be used. Like, you just want a new phone, or perhaps it's no longer usable for the new operational system, but it doesn't mean that they have no value. Most people in the world have mobile phones as well, so it's really growing as a category of waste. He was in Bornell, saw a lot of electronic waste, but also he realized the challenge of monitoring tropical forests for illegal logging. Mm-hmm. We usually think of satellite data, and satellite data is amazing, but satellite data captures vast areas being degraded, and also it doesn't necessarily allow for quick reactions. It takes time mm-hmm. to notice and to respond, and very often illegal loggers are gone. The other possibility for like real-time monitoring of illegal logging is helicopters, drones, right? People patrolling, like walking around the forests. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine how challenging and costly that is. And most tropical forests in the world are in low and middle-income countries that don't have big budgets to invest mm-hmm. in that. Then he thought, let's work around these funding constraints and use these things that are going to waste, these mobile phones. And he started taking these old mobile phones and putting them on tree canopies. And they were constantly charged because they were charged with solar energy. Mm-hmm. And in a tropical forest, there's no shortage of solar energy. So the phones are listening constantly, right? Phones do that. They capture sound. And then he created a very basic AI that distinguishes the sound of chainsaws from the sounds of the forest. So once the phone captures the sound of a chainsaw, it sends a signal, a message, like phones do already, to the patrol. And because the patrols know where the phones are, and the phones are spread in a forest to maximize coverage, they know what is the radius from that phone. So they can know precisely where the illegal logging is happening, and they can try to prevent that from expanding or try to capture the illegal loggers.
How many Amazon rainforests, tropical rainforests, have masts? So what is the how did they overcome the technical problem of actually not having a signal? Did they do something? Did they get the phones to communicate in a peer-to-peer way or something? Or
that experience in Bornell, they actually had access to networks, like the networks.
Oh, okay. Fab.
And I've worked in the Amazon as well, in several areas that are not that distant from urban regions have seen.
Right. And of course, if you're an illegal logger, actually proximity to urban centers is really quite helpful, because you're going to drive in some trucks, cut down some logs and take them away quickly. You're not going to go 100 miles into the deep jungle past all of these other trees. You're going to go, where are the first trees? I see.
Yeah, because then you can dispose of. But also, like, these mobile phones don't necessarily need internet because they're sending SMS.
SMS, yeah.
It's much easier. Like, very often in remote regions, you have access to that network.
So that's fab. Creating something with waste.
Yeah. And there's so many, like, resources don't have to be tangible resources, right? I gave an example of a phone, but you can think of human capital being a resource, or you can think of a legal case being a resource. And I have examples for all these different kinds of resources that are recombined or repurposed to work around a very tough obstacle.
Would this be like the sort of the other end of the innovator's dilemma, right? Because often you have things like steel gets, you know, rebar, you know, I'm just thinking about business cases, you know, Honda launching into the United States, they launch a product which the main supplier doesn't want to compete, and then they eat their customers away from the bottom. You know, that's the, you know, the scrappy supplier says, I'm going to take the customers that they don't want anymore, and then we're going to build a bridgehead. Whereas the bigger suppliers always go, oh no, it has to be as good as.
The many workarounds by companies that are trying to bypass the incumbents, right?
And, yeah.
And we see that very often, how they are resourceful in how they approach business development. I have several cases of like startups like Airbnb, right? That grew like Wise, a financial bank, or M-Pesa, that represent that idea of like working around tough constraints by leveraging what already exists and repurposing resources or finding unconventional pairings, right?
It's the whole hotel room versus sleeping in somebody's house is the next best thing, isn't it? It's like, you know, you need a bed, but you don't necessarily need a hotel room. You just need a bed. So, you know, the hotels weren't going to launch a system of renting people's bedrooms.
Yeah.
Because it's not their business model. So what are some of those other case studies you've got there using Next Best?
I have several. I have like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because like policymakers, judges, right, like lawyers, we can all pursue these workarounds. It's not exclusive to like businesses or nonprofits. Uh-huh. We can all do that, and probably most of us do already, but not systematically.
Yes.
The Next Best, I have cases, for example, of technologies that were created through Next Bests.
Go on, give me one of those.
So, for example, there's this organization called Zipline that realized they want to invest in drones and develop cutting-edge technology for drones. Not only hardware, but also in understanding how they can navigate very busy airspaces, right? Which is a challenge. Like drones will not be delivering your Amazon Prime in New York, for example, because it's pretty challenging to think of busy airspaces. So they went to spaces that are not that busy and found use for the technologies in a very early moment. And they did that in Rwanda. Where there's a big issue in rural regions to stock blood for blood transfusions. First, because they don't necessarily have the infrastructure to take people's blood, but also refrigeration and also transportation from urban regions. So very challenging obstacles, very costly. And they started using drones to take blood for blood transfusions from Kigali, the capital, to rural regions, because the population is sparsely distributed in the country, right? It's not a very densely populated urban region.
I think from memory, having their fixed-wing drones, they get sort of catapulted out into the air, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. So they experimented with different technologies. They developed, now they have intellectual properties that will likely be used as the company grows and reaches other markets, including busier airspaces in high-income countries. So you can use a Next Best to work around obstacles and create a sort of test bed for early-stage technology.
Fab. And what's the last of your four?
The fourth I call the roundabout. And the reason for that is because it's about self-reinforcing behaviors, or what we usually call vicious cycles or virtual cycles. So to give an example, like before I tell you about the workaround, because it's a bit more technical, this idea of self-reinforcing behaviors. When I was a child, I fought a lot against my brother. He would come and flick me. I would slap him. I would punch him. And then he would choke me. And then suddenly we're trying to kill each other, right?
It's what boys do.
Yeah, exactly. Every system has that. So let's think of like landslides. It's a small rock that knocks a bigger rock that knocks a bigger rock that knocks a bigger rock, and then suddenly it's a landslide. your body, right? Like the more you eat carbs, the more you feel like eating carbs, and the more you eat carbs, and then things spiral out of control. So systems have this behavior, what we call self-reinforcing behavior. And it's sometimes very challenging to disturb the self-reinforcing behaviors because they become normalized. Things become almost seen as inevitable. So let me give an example. And again, I will choose the scrappiest case I have in my data set for this. That was something that I bumped into. I wasn't planning to study this. I was walking in Delhi, and then I saw that public urination is quite common.
Yes.
You see men, and it's really men, it's very gendered, urinating in public spaces, and usually like walls. So let's say you have a wall, a house with a wall facing the street. It's very likely that your wall would be drenched in urine. Like I spoke, for example, with a policeman, and they would say, oh, that's what men do. You know, like people have tried to build public toilets, but men will urinate everywhere. This is India. They have been doing this forever, right? Like, and the more people urinate in a public space, the more it becomes normalized, and then others yeah. feel like it's okay, right? So it's a, this is a self-reinforcing behavior. And then this genius workaround that I identified in walls that were very clean. So across the street from a very stinky wall, you would find a clean wall. And the reason for that was because wall owners started putting tiles of Hindu gods on the walls. And the rationale here is, if you live in India, a country where the majority of the population is Hindu, you're not going to drench a god in urine. That's blasphemy, yes. right? That's yeah. one of the worst heresies you can make. So this literally diverted the stream elsewhere.
Yes.
of the self-reinforcing behavior. People stop urinating in those spaces and then they become cleaner over time. That's a very simple and scrappy example of how you can disturb a self-reinforcing behavior, right? But I have cases of people working around their bosses, for example, in companies like HP.
Uh-huh.
Hewlett-Packard, because they knew that in an early stage of technological development, the idea is super rough.
Yeah.
And very likely when a company is growing, they become a bit more rigid in choosing what they're going to invest in for mm-hmm. R&D and for technological development more broadly. And this employee, Chuck House, had this idea he wanted to pursue, but he thought that his boss, who was Packard, the P of HP, would not allow him to pursue that idea because it was not really aligned with the strategy, not necessarily, like the idea was still rough. And then he worked around his boss and developed this underground idea until the moment was ripe to present that. So like once the technology became attractive enough, he knew what would work, what wouldn't work, the shape, the design. Then he went public and told his boss. And that ended up being a large display screen that made HP a lot of money.
Yeah.
And Chuck House got a Medal of Defiance from Packard for doing that. And you may have already heard about these policies that some companies have, like 3M, HP, Google, give like 10 to 15 or 20% of time for personal projects. That came out of many experiences like this that I just described. People working around their bosses to develop a personal project they were passionate about and waiting until the moment was ripe to present that publicly when people could already see the product market fit.
Yes. Fabulous. Roundabout. That's really good. I think the idea of having a series of cases and being able to teach people, because it can't be done. You know, you're just trying to get the inertia taken away so that it's like, you know, I just think, see, maybe it's just me, right? I just get so much joy out of like being scrappy and solving a problem and working with clients and going, but there's a thing, right? You know, you could do this pattern matching, you could do a thing.
And for me as a nerdy academic, it also reminds us that there's something common between a wall owner in Delhi who put tiles of Hindu gods on the wall and someone who was a high paying employee at HP, right? Like they use sometimes a similar approach and for different purposes in different contexts, but they have something common. And how this crappiness is so pervasive, right? And it can, and going back to what you asked me before, it can be stimulated if we boil down the core traits, the essence of these approaches, like I tried to do.
I came away from the book thinking that you'd boil down the essence of entrepreneurism, right? Because you know, if you think about your deli example, right? There are like the policemen are just like, I don't care, it's not my problem, right? And there are lots of people who have walls drenched in piss, and they don't seem to care either. But for some people have decided that they're going to do something about it. And then somebody spots a thing that works, and then a couple of people copy it, but not everybody, right? Your mindset must, you know, because in many businesses, as they get bigger, we have these things that I call Doctor Who moments where the founder says, but we used to do that. And you go back and you say to somebody, but didn't we used to do that? Like that thing we did for customers that drove a whole lot of value. And they go, oh yeah, we just stopped. And it's like, why? And it's like, you know, like they, instead of thinking about the customer, they're just thinking about it was just too hard. It was just, you know, and so, you know, you'd see a house and you go, okay, well, you've got those tiles, and somebody buys the house and just paints over the tiles, and somebody starts pissing on the wall. And like, yeah, so it doesn't feel as though it's a mental model that everybody can apply. And it does feel as though, you know, those people who are wired in a way to spot piggybacking and loopholing and roundabouts and, you know, next best, are they entrepreneurs? Is it an entrepreneurial trait? Could you build a scrappy business without this? It felt as though, reading it, I felt as though, like, you know, you couldn't.
I agree with you. I think that it's very core to entrepreneurialism. But also, I think that we all in our daily lives face complex problems. Complex, I don't mean necessarily big problems or complicated problems. I mean complex, that there are many causes for the problem. It's difficult to tell what these causes are. It's a bit challenging to work with them, right, and understand or fully engage with them. And that could be like how you exercise daily and fit exercise in your daily routine, or could be anything like how do I cover my monthly budget for housing, right? Like we all face different kinds of problems in our daily or professional lives, and workarounds are excellent in addressing them. It's welcoming complexity instead of trying to prevent complexity. It's a bit fruitless.
I've got one for you. The late, great Michael Mosley, I was listening to a podcast that he was on, and he said, one of the things is over 65, there's a staggering percentage, it's 30% of people over 65 who fall are dead within a year, something like, it's like horrific enough, right? And so, you know, how do you prevent falling? Well, you have to improve your balance. Well, you know, don't wait until you're 65 to improve your balance. So his hack, his roundabout, because this is like, how do you build on a system that already exists and self-reinforce, is you already brush your teeth. Right, you're already brushing your teeth for 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes in the evening. So when you brush your teeth in the morning, you stand on your left leg, and when you do it in the evening, you stand on your right leg. Right, so it takes up no time. It only takes a tiny amount of cognitive element. You know, it doesn't take much to do that. And I'm the type of person who will then go, that makes so much sense. I'm in. And so I remember listening to that podcast, and I stood on one leg brushing my teeth for the last, I don't know, 5 years. So who knows whether it'll solve the problem for me and I won't ever fall down. Maybe I wouldn't have fallen down anyway, but I love the light bulb moment. Some people obviously just see something like that and just go, yeah, and move on. I'm fascinated by these heuristics and stacking habits and, you know, all rules are made up, life's not fair, nobody's coming to save you stuff. So Paolo, it's been brilliant. As well as people going and getting the four workarounds, your fabulous book, what other books could people pick up? What's given you some joy or inspiration?
I'll choose books that are very different from mine.
Okay.
that gave me inspiration for different reasons, right? One of the books that I love the most is called Factfulness by Hans Rosling.
It's lovely.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Finished by his daughter? Is that right?
His son and his daughter-in-law.
Yes, but it's a great book.
Still around the foundation because he passed away, Hans Rosling. Yeah. And sorry, I should have mentioned that it's the three authors. But Hans Rosling became very famous for creating Minda and the foundation that worked on development with many organizations, including the Gates Foundation. And the idea of factfulness is that we misinterpret reality. We make bad calls on facts. And he explains the reasons for that. But it's not what many people would necessarily expect. And he shows how you can make more factful decisions. One experiment he used to do that I thought was super interesting was that he gave clickers to people and asked questions, like multiple choice questions. And for these questions, even in places like the World Economic Forum, people would answer the questions completely incorrectly, but like worse than a monkey, for example, would do. If we had done that with monkeys would answer randomly, right? So if it's four questions, it's about 25% chance for each of the answers to that question. And the humans were doing worse than that, worse than random. So we are actually making very poor decisions that are poorly informed, and we can be more factful. That's the essence of the book, and I really enjoyed, recommend it to everyone. I read a book recently that is called How to Change the World. I really enjoyed it as well. We're constantly bombarded by news on social and environmental problems. And these are the things that keep me awake at night, right? And motivate my work as well. But I think that the news are quite pessimistic and sometimes are not very factful. Using Hans Rosling approach. The book shows it gives a more optimistic view and shows different prospects as well for several environmental challenges. And I just thought that it was refreshing. It made me happy. It made me more optimistic. And it was a read that I did right after New Year's Eve. So it was a good way of starting the year. And the third book I'm going to recommend is not about workarounds. It's not about scrappiness, but it's very good in describing originality. It's by Adam Grant, Originals. I think it's a quick and easy read, some interesting examples, but shows how one can think unconventionally, showing that in many different instances of life. So three very different books, but I think they all connect somehow with my work on workarounds, whether it's the unconventional approaches or thinking beyond the status quo or the default ways of approaching reality or facts, or if it's thinking about how we can tackle problems in resourceful ways and having a more optimistic view on approaching complex problems.
Paolo, thank you very much indeed for those recommendations, and thank you for coming on the show and talking about your book. It's been fantastic. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you, Dominic. It was a pleasure.
Brilliant. Thanks. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.